senior analyst Nate Schwartz, who joins us on the podcast. Nate, I'm going to let you go first. How are things up your way?
Good. Fully in draft season. They got the World Baseball Classic final on as we record. It feels like we're fully in it, and I'm excited that we've made it through the harsh, cold winter, and we're approaching the best time of the year.
Beautiful. Nate, thank you for joining us. And Scott, you're back with us like you are every week. I don't know about you up in Michigan, but I know we had a 70-degree day this week and then about an inch of snow this morning. So have you guys had the bipolar weather as well?
Still the harsh, cold winter here in Michigan, but we're getting through it. It's ugly. It's horrible. It's not good for baseball, except sometimes when it snows during baseball, it's sweet. Like back when Miggy hit a home run on opening weekend in the snow, like that was dope, but this is less dope. This is just snow in March.
Yeah, I'll never forget. I was at the Orioles opening day game where Jay Gibbons lost the ball in right field when they were playing the Guardians and it went behind him. It was like a triple and then they gave us a snow delay. I was at that game in person. It was one of the best games I've ever seen. One of the most fun things. But other than that, snow kind of stinks. But
tell me, you can't find a white ball in white snow? Weird.
Yeah, in the outfield on a routine pop fly. Yeah, it was ugly. But the umps called it right after that. Well, let's get right into introducing Nate and his work. Nate, you're the host of the Approach Angle podcast. That's one of the newest additions to the Pitcherless podcast network this year. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah. So us and the Shallows, Shallow Leagues Focus Pod, are two of the new podcasts this year. But the Approach Angle podcast, I'm one of the hosts. The other one is the incredible Kyle Bland, director of research and data analytics at Pitcherless. We really wanted to create that as a way to teach, you know, the listener everything about baseball analytics, ranging from, you know, your new pitch cards that you see on social media now to the ins and outs of something like isolated power. We know a lot of times, especially today, that there may be too many stats out there for the average or even the diehard fantasy player. And we want to be able to dissect some of those, break them down, and, you know, make it more understandable for anyone who's following baseball, whether you're a beginner trying to learn more about some of these stats or you're, you know, well in it, you know, a lot of these things and want to get an even deeper understanding. So we're going to be going through a lot of these stats, a lot of different, you know, niche topics within baseball, hopefully have on a lot of great guests, and really excited to see what that podcast becomes as we go through a full season.
Yeah. I know that we rely a lot on rolling charts and all the, you know, different stats. And one of the stats that we look at, I know Scott certainly looks at, is Process Plus. And that's something that came out of one of your articles, the FSWA Research Article of the Year. Congratulations on that prestigious award. And tell us a little bit about what Process Plus is and how to apply it to improve as a fantasy manager.
Yeah, so Process Plus, again, created by the wonderful Kyle Bland. So this guy, you know, may know what he's doing or something, but it was created as a way to quantify the hitter experience. We know on the pitching side, it's very easy to find your Stuff Plus model or even some of your ERA estimators such as FIP, Sierra, you know, XERA, that are very straightforward. It directly compares to what that performance is for a pitcher. And on the hitting side, it's not, you know, it's not clear. There's all sorts of arguments of, you know, does batting average incorrectly define a hitter? You know, OPS, WRC plus, all of these things culminating in one single stat describe a hitter, but we didn't really ever have something that did that on the predictive side. So Process Plus is our version of expected WRC plus. So it's a normalized stat where anytime you see it quoted by Scott or anyone in the articles, 100 is average, 125 is 25% better than average, and 75 is 25% worse. But what it does is it quantifies the three different aspects to hitting. It takes your contact ability, so how well are you putting bat to ball when you swing, your power, which is pretty self-explanatory of, you know, how often are you getting to, how often are you hitting power when you make contact, and then your decision value, which is your swing decisions, your take decisions, count dependent, situation dependent. And it becomes really powerful when you put them all together, and it's based on our PLV stat, which is pitch level value. So quantifying the stuff and location of the pitch. And we found that it is really predictive at predicting WRC plus for the next season, or defining what a true talent is within season. So when you see these numbers, or if you're a PitcherList Pro subscriber and you have access to these numbers, you're able to really get in the weeds of, okay, who has a process plus that's way lower than their current expectations. And maybe I can sell high on that player and don't buy a current hot streak, or vice versa, of someone who's not performing as well as you think they should be. But it's become really neat in seeing, especially on the decision level, the decision value level side of things, where you can see which players are making good decisions and how that's kind of impacting everything else, and vice versa, who's making bad decisions and is, you know, able to compensate for that, or in some cases not compensate for that. So I really, you know, I use it. I enjoyed writing about it, but I use it in my day-to-day analysis as much as I can, because it really is so powerful. And I think a great kind of way to describe it is that if you're a hitter and you take a 99 mile an hour fastball on the black deep, you're going to get a lot of credit for that. You will get more credit for that than hitting a 90 mile an hour fastball down the middle for a homer. And even your WRC pluses or some of your other stats aren't going to fully quantify that in one number, and process plus does. So really giving that holistic view on a hitter is, you know, makes it a very complete stat that, you know, I was lucky enough to win an award for, but it becomes a real tool of analysis once you get into the season.
And I think something that's really interesting about process plus is, because it takes all three of those factors together, you not only get to see who's rocking a good WRC plus, you get to see how they're doing that, right? How are you getting to a good process plus? Because not all process pluses are made equal, right? Like, some process plus are really heavy on, the most common example would be a process plus that's really heavy on power and really light on everything else. We were just talking before the show. A good example of this was like 2024 Tyler Fitzgerald from the Giants, right? Like, he had a great process plus, but it was just because every time he hit the ball, he hit it really, really hard, but he made really bad decisions and he didn't actually hit the ball when he was supposed to, right? Like, his contact ability was bad. The decision-making was bad. It's just that when he did hit the ball, he hit it really, really hard, which is so hard to do for any extended period of time, right? Like, you're living on the margins. There's like the Kyle Schwarbers of the world who can get by with really poor contact ability, but that's because he makes good decisions at the plate, right? And so then his power gets to go all the way. It is so hard to live with just power and then bad decision value, bad contact, right? Like, if you're just average in those things, you can probably get by, right? Even if you're average in just like one of those things and great with power, you can get by. But if you're like super heavy on power and really bad at everything else, or you're, you know, however you want to get there, it's mostly power. It's a way to understand how a player is being good. Not just are they good, but how are they being good? How sustainable is that? Right? Like, it, process plus is really predictive, but it's all about finding the moments where it's less predictive, right? Like, where you're like, okay, it's a good process plus, but should I believe it? And when it's like super loaded in power and nothing else, you're like, you know, like, this was good, but I don't believe it. So it's really nice, especially with the rolling charts that we have. If you're a PL Pro, you get to see exactly what is making up this process plus, as opposed to just like the raw number.
And I think on that, from the, you know, you want to go one step deeper in analysis side, it's really useful to be able to see the three components to know where to look. Sometimes when you see a 110 WRC plus, you have to look at five or six different stats, you know, maybe go between the PitcherList page, Baseball Savant, Fangraphs to find, you know, your EV90, your ICR, you know, whatever it may be, that you have to look for where does that come from outside of just the surface level stats. And for process plus, you pull up one of the rolling charts, you see that maybe it's that 110, and you see that it's driven by power and the contact's really bad. So it's okay, now I'm going to go look into this guy's contact ability. Can I trust it for the rest of the season, for next year? It really gives you an easy jumping off point for going one step deeper that I think can sometimes be daunting to a lot of people who are looking to get, you know, one step deeper and find that edge on league mates or just general analysis.
Well, we'll take a quick break. When we come back to Hacks and Jacks, we'll jump into news and notes and then dive into the list after this. Welcome back to Hacks and Jacks. I'm your host, Brett Ford, joined as always by Scott Chu and special guest this week, Nate Schwartz. We're talking hitters on pitcher list. Let's jump right into news and notes. Obviously, the World Baseball Classic is going on as we record. Currently, Venezuela up 2-0 on a Willier Abreu home run. We're professionals. We're not watching. It's definitely not streaming in a separate tab where we can see it in the top corners of our computers or on a separate monitor or anything like that. Definitely not. So speaking of World Baseball Classic, we had a couple of knocks. I won't call them injuries. I'll call them knocks to come out of that. Cleveland Guardians third baseman Jose Ramirez suffered some shoulder inflammation. He's already back in action. There's nothing there to worry about, right?
Nope. Perfect. Like, so here's the thing. Here's the thing. Let's just get this out of the way. Some dude will have like inflammation, right? Like we all suffer from inflammation, right? Like to some extent or another as adults, right? Like we're just constantly inflamed somewhere, right? And we pop some ibuprofen and we get over it. He's not a pitcher. A little bit of inflammation when he's able, if he wasn't okay, he wouldn't be playing a spring training game. Like that's it. I hate to just oversimplify everything, but if you're a star player and they let you play the next spring training game, it means you're fine.
We'll move on to another star player in Chicago. Outfielder Seiya Suzuki is getting an MRI on his knee after an injury, I believe, that was suffered in the World Baseball Classic. I didn't see the play, but it looks like he's been diagnosed, and this is from earlier this afternoon. It looks like he's been diagnosed with a strained PCL. His IL status is currently uncertain, but now that he's back with the Cubs, it wouldn't be surprising for me to see him start the year on the IL. Nate, I know that you were high on him coming in, obviously, before the injury. Are you looking at this draft discount as something you like, or are you worried about the injury and spending time on the injury list?
I'm still buying. So he banged his knee. It looked like on a head first slide where the knee, I think, came down a little bit lower than he expected. But he was able to walk off in his own, under his own power. The Cubs said it was good news on the update. They said, you know, it was minor in nature, I think. And maybe he misses the first couple of games, but it doesn't seem like something that's going to get an IL stint. And he didn't really steal many bases last year anyway. The 2024 15 stolen bases, I think, is a thing of the past and seems like more of an outlier than anything. So I'm not really worried about that tanking his stock and all. And I think he'll be, you know, still a great hitter for the full 2026 year.
I think it's a great opportunity to buy in, right? Because people are going to go into drafts the next 2 weekends and they're going to see a little a designation next to his name. They're like, oh, I don't know about that. But like, dude, it's cold in Chicago the first 2 weeks, right? Like it makes a ton of sense for them to just be like, look, we're probably not even going to play half the home games, you know, during the first 2 weeks of the season. It's freezing up here. It just snowed in Chicago, like just now. So I could totally see them, even if they put him on the IL. In fact, part of me hopes they do put him on the IL because that doesn't really change how many games you were projecting him for anyway. It's still like 130 to 140 really good games. Like that's what you were hoping for in the first place. This changes nothing.
And he's going to DH for the most part in Chicago, right? Like they're not going to roll him out into, you know, right field that often.
102 DHs last year. There's no reason it wouldn't be the same now.
Yeah, exactly. So definitely, you know, something to keep an eye on if he's got a little red Q or a little red D in your draft queue on whatever platform you're drafting on that might scare your league mates off of them. You might be able to get a draft discount on Seiya Suzuki. Thankfully, that's pretty much all the injury news that we have for the past week, at least for hitters. And anytime we don't have hitter injury news is a good week. So let's jump right into Scott's top 300 hitters list. And with Nate here, we'll discuss some of Nate's notes at the bottom of each tier. So we'll go through, take a look at all the tiers. And after each one, we'll kind of let Scott and Nate I don't want to say battle it out because I don't want this to be an adversarial discussion necessarily, but we'll let Nate talk through some of his notes. And then if Scott has a rebuttal, we'll let him jump in there as well. So let's start at the top. Tiers one and two, no brainers here, right? There's not a ton to talk about. Anything you guys want to touch on before we move on to the next tier?
I mean, I think the only thing for me, and I know Scott and I went back and forth on this one a few times when he was doing the rankings, but I'm really confident in Bobby Witt as that fourth ranked hitter. I just think the upside in the average and I think there's going to be a strong bounce back in power for him this year, especially with the Kauffman fence coming in a little bit. And, you know, I'm not going to slight Jose Ramirez for being slightly banged up in a spring game, but I'm just so worried about being caught in the year that it falls off. I know he's been as consistent as can be, but when I'm picking it that high in the draft, I want someone to give me something just a little bit safer. And, you know, I will go with Witt in that situation.
I think the main takeaway that I've had, and I actually did this when I set up my KDS rankings for TGFBI, is I love picking five because I'm getting one of Juan Soto, Jose Ramirez, or Bobby Witt. And I don't even have to think about it. I just get one of those dudes, right? There's a real joy in not really having to think. There's just like setting your queue in whatever order you want, but it doesn't matter what order because one of them is going to fall to you. Maybe you have to think because someone took Scoobs or Skeens in those first couple picks. Like maybe, but even then, like, oh no, what a conundrum, right? I have to pick between Bobby Witt and Jose Ramirez. Like you're in a great spot. I think it's one of the perfect places to draft from. If you can't get one of the top two guys, because I do think, I mean, that's obviously a tier of its own. If you can't get one of those two guys, I go straight to fifth because I don't think the gap between in a standard league, Jose Ramirez, Bobby Witt, and Juan Soto. I mean, I think you're not really losing anything between them. You're going to get all five categories. You're going to get power. You're going to get everything you want. Maybe like a little bit more speed instead of power. If you go with Bobby Witt, you'll get a third baseman if you pick Jose Ramirez, and you'll get, you know, Juan Soto if you pick Juan Soto. But I mean, it's just a great spot to draft. Fifth is an awesome spot to be.
Yeah, I'm definitely finding myself enjoying being at the top of drafts this year. Usually I like to do something a little bit later, give myself some more options on the turn, and set myself up with two of the, you know, great first round, early second round, either bats, maybe an arm, though that's not something I often do. But this year I'm really gravitating toward the top of give me just an incredible option at the top. And then I hate overthinking a first round pick sometimes, and it's very nice to have that stability with whoever you're getting.
Yeah. Anytime I can pick without using my brain, it's probably an advantage for me. So going second and getting either Shohei or Judge, or going fifth and getting one of the other three bats you mentioned, is just fine with me. Let's jump down to tier three. And Nate, in your note in tier three, you mentioned that you felt the first basemen were ranked a little bit aggressively here. Does that mean that you'd prefer to wait on first baseman in most of your draft formats?
Yes, but not too much. I think there is a real importance in banking that either power or primarily the counting stats and runs in RBI from the first base position. But I'm really looking at doing that ideally from like a Freddie Freeman or a Vinny Pasquantino. I think you can wait a little bit, maybe grab a different positional need, because I think the first basemen are getting pushed up almost too much sometimes, where sometimes there's more five-tool players that I want to target in the round that some of those guys are going at. And I think there are a lot of options intriguing late that you can fill a CI position with or a utility spot with. Like Wilson Contreras is a great one who's going super late. I've really been into Andrew Vaughn this draft season, and I know we'll definitely get to him later, but Sal Stewart, I'm just really, really in on. Even more so finding out that his full name is Sal, not Salvatore or anything. So, I just think there's a lot of options at the position that give you the flexibility to not have to really sell out that high ADP for a Kurtz, a Caminero, not Caminero, a Guerrero or Alonso.
Yeah, I think the one thing that has struck me a lot as I've actually done drafts that may change these rankings a little bit is there are values, even if you don't want to go that low, right, on value and be like, I'm going to wait a long time and get like a Sal Stewart or a Spencer Torkelson or something like that, or a Wilson Contreras. Like, I love Josh Naylor. I am higher on Josh Naylor than so much else. And I can get him so much later and I lose so little value. Right. Because like, again, I've been very clear that I'm a believer in Josh Naylor's stolen base ability, despite the lack of speed. He's going back to the same team, the same manager, the same role on a team that really wants to stay competitive. He was a consistent base stealer all year. And I can get him so much later. Like, people just don't want him for some reason. Like, they obviously don't read my stuff because Josh Naylor's amazing. He's all hustle and grit and amazingness, and people don't seem to want him. So I'm actually finding that, like, when it's actually time to make those picks, they are on top of my board. I do think they're the most valuable hitter in that spot, and I tend to gravitate towards a pitcher or something anyway because I'm like, I think I'll get Josh Naylor for a great value, and I'll be set.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that gets often missed sometimes in drafts is you go in with a mindset about a position, especially first base, or I think third base is another great one, where you're like, I'm going to be at the top of the range, or I'm going to punt it, and I'll find something late. And I think it's really important to be able to plan for that middle guy, plan for Naylor, plan for Pasquantino. So rather than, you know, pivoting, oh, I didn't get my tier A option, you know, in the first three or four rounds, I have to panic, grab a first baseman, I'm going to take Vinny Pasquantino, you know, 15 picks above ADP. You're setting yourself up for that. So you don't have to, you know, plan, you know, about you're trying to avoid disaster. Oh, this draft is already off the rails. And, you know, you're not punting the position, but you're, you know, patiently waiting for your guys.
Yeah, I love that. And as a reminder, these rankings aren't necessarily congruent to drafts, right? Like, there's some guys who are pushed up in the rankings that, yes, you should take them earlier, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to grab them at the same time as the others. So there are guys like Josh Naylor who may be up a tier or two that you can still grab with some of the guys from a tier below him. So just know that Scott's rankings aren't necessarily congruent to draft ADP and things like that.
That's a really good point, Brett. I think it's really important to understand the difference between what ranks give you and what ADP give you. ADP tells you when to take a guy. Ranks tell you how valuable I think he is, right? Those are two very different things. So when you look at an ADP and you look at ranks, you're like, wow, this dude's ADP is way lower than his rank. That doesn't mean I have to take him the moment he's the top player left on my board. If Josh Naylor's the top player left on my board, but there's still two rounds worth of ADP, I'm like, well, I think I can wait one more, right? Like, you're trying to play ADP to get the most value per draft slot, right? It doesn't mean take them. It doesn't mean draft them in this order. It means I think this is how valuable they are in this order, and you should play the ADP to try to get as much of this value as you can.
And I think in that kind of vein, it's very, you know, we talk about hitting decision value a lot of the time, but I think that draft decision value is so important of, one, being able to read the room of, oh, are these guys, is every flashy pick that I've read on some list on Scott's rankings going two rounds ahead of schedule? And do I need to be jumping on that guy? Or can I wait a little bit? Is this more of an oatmeal-y player that, you know, I can wait, I'm not as worried? Because there's nothing worse than, you know, getting sniped in a draft sucks. It's never fun to be like, oh, I got this guy. You're already planning what your next pick's going to be. But, you know, taking a pick and everyone not talking about, you know, who that player was, and you're like, oh, well, that was unexpected. And that, I think, can sometimes be a worse feeling. So really being able to leverage what the draft room's like and how your rankings are fitting in with everyone, especially what platform you're on, you know, what is everyone looking at, I think is just really, really important.
I'm going to need Kyle Bland to come up with some draft decision value rolling charts for me personally. Maybe we can work that in.
I don't want to know what mine are.
Yeah, no. No, I don't need that kind of hate right now.
Let's move on to tier four, where Nate, you're really high on Ronald Acuna. And I feel like that feeds into your argument about toolsy players, right? You talked about guys who can contribute in all five categories, and Ronald Acuna certainly fits that mold. Talk to us about what we can expect there.
But before Nate goes, I do want to say, it's probably more accurate to say I am super low on Acuna. Like, if you look at every ADP, every projection out there, I am lower on Acuna by like 10 to 15 rank spots, right? So like, it's less like, oh, Nate, you're really high on Acuna. No, Scott's super low on Acuna, and Nate is now going to tell you why everyone else is not so low on Acuna.
Yeah, I know his ADP in all of the industry leagues, NFBC, is just absolutely skyrocketing today, or, you know, right now. I was helping a friend out with a draft, and I was like, you know, you could take him at six if you wanted to. Like, it's not the, you know, if you like it, like, absolutely go for it. But the biggest thing for me on Acuna was that he ran in the winter league, you know, showing health, showing some desire to do it. And we kind of saw the blueprint for how he stole these bases in 2021 and 2022, where, or sorry, 2022 and 2023. He came back from injury after getting hurt in 21, and he runs some, but nothing crazy. And it's like, oh, is this kind of fading? And then he has the healthy offseason. He comes back, and obviously we're not going to get 70 stolen bases again, but that was just absolutely exceptional. And he's showing us all of the things that lead into, oh, he could steal 35, he could steal 40 again. And those are the things that absolutely entice me really early in drafts, especially if he's going to fall to, you know, a little bit later in the first round, where that upside is just exceptional. And at the same time, if he's just going to steal, you know, 20 bags, he's a good enough hitter to overcome that. And I'm not too worried. We talked about, you know, what goes into Process Plus a little bit earlier. And for Acuna, his, you know, really exceptional numbers that I think are, you know, around 125, 130 on last year, is that he has really, really good power, and he makes exceptional decisions. It's only the contact that lags behind. So it's telling me that he is a proficient power hitter who is knowing how to leverage his power. And it wouldn't surprise me if he's able to tap into much more homer power this year. And I'm so excited to see what he has to offer over a full season. I think you add in the stolen bases, and he's almost assuredly going to be first round production this year.
For sure. I think the only point I made, look, if you are willing to project 140 games for Ronald Acuna, he is absolutely worth a first round pick. There's no doubt about that, right? I'm super pessimistic on that because we've seen that twice, right? We've seen him play more than 75% of the available games in a season twice, right? I guess technically three times. He played 46 games in the 60 game 2020 that gave him like just over 75%. Like, he just gets hurt. So for me, I kind of ranked him with another dude that's hurt all the time that I think is a first round talent. Even though he doesn't steal bases, Yordan Alvarez is probably one of the best pure hitters in all of baseball. He is Juan Soto level good with the bat. He just doesn't run. That's the only thing, because he doesn't have any knees. But Yordan Alvarez is that good. He's just hurt all the time, right? Obviously, there's an extra ceiling to Ronald Acuna Jr. because he can run. He can hit the 40 home runs, and he can steal the 40 bases, and he can do all these things. No doubt about that. It's just like, it doesn't usually work out that way, right? Like, usually he has been outside the top 50 hitters more times than he's been inside it, right? In terms of full season. And that's simply because of injury. Again, on a per plate appearance basis, this is one of the best players in all of baseball. He has been, even on his down years, he's incredibly good on a per plate appearance basis. It's just that he doesn't get enough plate appearances, right? Like, that's it. So that's where my ranking is saying, I'm just really pessimistic on the health, not because he isn't healthy now, but because something always seems to happen, right? But if you want to say like, hey, look, I think, you know, I'm in a shallower league. I think I can play the wire if he misses games. And if he can give me 100, I'm still good. Then you should take him earlier than I rank him.
Yeah, I think on my end, on how I play, of I will trust that I can find the correct replacement guys on the wire. So I will take the risk of that, of he's producing. And yes, the preseason projections aren't going to pop as much because, you know, you are projecting less games, but you are getting value for those games. It's not like you are missing those at-bats in the sense when you're in the season. I think my only hesitation on Acuna's running, honestly, is that it feels like this, you know, the Braves season has kind of gone off the rails already in terms of injuries. And if they're sitting there, you know, maybe in May, and it's very clear that the top of the NL East is going to be competitive, and they're maybe in this purgatory as they wait for everyone to get healthy, do they pump the brakes a little bit and tell him, hey, you know, keep the bat on the field, stay healthy, don't run as much. You know, we need you for either later this year or next year or something like that. And that's purely anecdotal, purely me trying to read into something too much. But I think that's one way that he could be more limited on the base paths than, you know, a lot of people would want to dream on.
I think it's a great point. I think if he's limited, it's because this team is not in contention, right? I think I do think this team can still compete. They've got great ace level pitching. They've got hitters that should be better than they've been in the past between Austin Riley. I think, you know, Matt Olson is obviously a reliable hitter. Sure, they lost Jerks and Profar, but this season did not hinge upon Jerks and Profar, right? Like, he was a nice to have for them. He's not a need to have. I think they could still do it. But if this team does find itself out of contention in June, I think we could see them pump the brakes a little bit because, you know, Ronald Acuña Jr. is under contract through 2028, basically. He's got club options in 27 and 28. They're going to take those options because he's cheap as heck. I think you're absolutely right, Nate, in that if he falls below 30 stolen bases and he plays a whole season, that is why. I'm not saying that is what's going to happen. I'm saying if it so happens that he plays 140 games and he only steals, you know, 30 bases or so, that was why. It was because they fell out of contention and didn't want to risk it.
Well, let's move on to tiers 5 and 6. A lot of good talent in these tiers. Nate, one of the positions that you seem to focus on a little bit over these two tiers is catcher. You talk about perhaps skipping over Goodman and Langoliers at cost and then jumping on Ben Rice maybe a little bit later in drafts. As we've seen, I guess, NFBC circuits, as we've seen kind of more competitive drafts, Ben Rice's draft price seems to be going up, up, up. Are you still okay with taking him over Goodman, Langoliers in general, or are you thinking more just at cost?
I find myself still in on Ben Rice at cost. I think he's a little bit less streaky, and the profile, I think, to me, is a more overall hitter, is a little bit more encouraging than those two. I feel like I have fallen for a handful of Rockies hitters over the last handful of years, whether it was Nolan Jones, Brenton Doyle, Mickey Moniak, and even Goodman last year, I had a couple of shares of, and I'm just terrified that, you know, the bottom is going to fall out without really a discernible reason. And I know, I think Goodman is a better hitter than some of those other guys, but I'm really, you know, a little nervous, and Langoliers is a very streaky hitter. And in Ben Rice's sake, we know what the Statcast sliders look like. We know what the pitcherless player page looks like. It's all red. And I'm just really of the belief that he is going to be a star hitter this year. I think he gets to 30 home runs. And I think the biggest thing for me is that I don't think, after having 1 year, you know, kind of on that fringe breaking into the lineup, I think the Yankees are going to have a lot of trust in him to play more games, to not be in this full platoon situation. I was looking into his lefty ready splits, and yes, he only hit like 200 against lefties, but he was still had a 104 WRC plus. He would still hit 7 homers against lefties. He was definitely not a black hole in the lineup when lefties came up to hit. And that gives me, you know, confidence that he's going to be a good bat, get enough playing time, and he doesn't have to deal with the wear and tear of being a catcher. He's probably playing first base. This is probably our only year with him in that very, very nice catcher eligibility slot. So I'm really not as worried there. But kind of to your point about, you know, at cost, I think catcher is just as deep as can be this year. It really feels like there's a lot of, you know, early options, as we're talking about, that are great in the top 100 picks, but then also late, there's a lot of good dart throws that don't feel like they're really sinking your team. And I would rather wait and get a guy who might be fully serviceable, or maybe a dart throw, knowing that I can fill on the wire more than I might have been able to in years past.
Yeah, streaming catcher is easier than it's ever been. They won't be as good as the top five, right? It used to be the gap between like the fifth best guy and the 15th best guy wasn't a lot. That's not the case anymore. Now it's more like the gap between the 10th guy and the 20th guy is really not that much. But they're kind of like useful still. They're still very streamable. I think the one thing with Langoliers is that strikeout rate just falling down so hard in a single season. Jay Langoliers, like, I think if you only looked at his, you know, at his 2025, you'd be like, oh, this guy, he doesn't seem like, why do you say he's streaky? His profile doesn't seem like he's streaky. It's because this was like a 27 to 30% strikeout rate guy right up until last season. And really not even like, I shouldn't say up until last season, basically like out of nowhere, this dude just like stopped striking out for extended periods of time. He still has a couple spikes throughout the season, like in the middle of the year, but like it's a huge change for Shea Langeliers. And while the sample size is good enough for us to say like there's something sticky to this reduction in strikeouts, he's only done it the one time. And that, like, I hate to just gloss over everything and say, oh, he only did it the one time. And I love seeing in the spring that he's still not striking out so much in the spring, right? It's 45 play. He's played a ton this spring. He's only striking out 17.8% of the time. And that tells me like, hey, maybe he keeps that up. If he remains a, if you want to take on the risk of, if he remains a 20% strikeout guy instead of like 27.5 and above Shea Langeliers, then this is a truly elite catcher, right? Like this is a, there's a level above sort of like Ben Rice. Cause he's all, I mean, he's going to play a ton. He's got it all. And he doesn't have these weird random for no good reason slumps that Ben Rice has had in each of the last two seasons, long ones. And I wish I could tell you why. I've actually peppered our writers to be like, someone tell me why in God's name, Ben Rice keeps slumping for 2 months at a time for no reason. He's not hitting the ball softer. He's not accidentally hitting it on the ground more. Nothing is changing except he kind of hits it to center more for these like extended periods of times. And during those times, the Yankees decide like, yeah, we should platoon him. He's not getting it done. He's going to platoon. That's what keeps happening because it's not like they don't, it's not like nobody in the Yankees office has like, somebody in that office has like sort of on their Google browser has been like Ben Rice Statcast and opened it up and see all the red, right? Like that has happened. Somebody smart at the Yankees organization has seen that. They still platoon him and it's these weird slumps. So that is to say, I love Ben Rice. I wish I could explain those slumps so I could tell you what the risk is. All I can tell you is that they happen for no particularly good reason. And also I can tell you that Shea Langeliers is really exciting if he keeps that strikeout rate down, because then he can be like a, instead of being a batting average drag, he can actually do it all but steal bases, which is all you could ever ask a catcher to do.
Excellent. We'll take this to break real quick. When we come back, we'll talk tier 7 through however many we get to after this. Welcome back to Hacks and Jacks. I'm your host, Brett Ford, here with senior analyst Scott Chu and our special guest, senior analyst Nate Schwartz. And we're talking hitters on pitcher list as always. We've gotten through the first six tiers. We're checking out Nate's notes, a new feature on the hitters list this year. Nate kind of provides his feedback on Scott's rankings and Scott adjusts accordingly sometimes. that seems about right. Let's get down to tier 7 and 8. One of the guys, Nate, that you seem super high on is Marlins outfielder Jacob Marcy. Marcy made his debut last year, and a lot of people kind of saw him for his stolen bases primarily. But, you know, digging a little bit deeper into that profile, and there's a lot of good bat skills there. There's pop. There's some power. When I look at him, I kind of look like Chandler Simpson with a little less speed and a lot more bat.
Yeah, I think for Jacob Marcy, he is a functional everyday major league hitter, which I'm not convinced that Chandler Simpson is.
Chandler Simpson, because he's not.
Exactly.
Just to be clear.
Jacob Marcy is really fun. Obviously, I don't think any of the absurd rate stats that he played to in 2025 are going to stick in 2026. But the fade that which is happening to him, I think, is way overcorrecting for who he is. He made a pretty substantial swing change last year, which, mind you, was after he got traded from the Padres to the Marlins. So after the Marlins had a year of him in the org. And it seemed to really transform, you know, who he was as a hitter. He posted a max EV that was, I think, almost three or four miles an hour harder than what he had before. All of a sudden, he was able to hit for average and tap into a little bit of that power that we really hadn't seen from him in addition to running. And all of a sudden, he looks like this really good fantasy asset that you can get pretty late in drafts. And I think the thing for me that has me all over him is, as we talked about before, you know, you need to be able to leverage where the rankings are and where you have a guy versus where the market is taking him. And for everyone who's drafting off of a variety of projection sets, they'll see that he has career minor league averages in the, you know, low 200s. He's hit 200 in a minor league season, and that doesn't, you know, give you any confidence that he's going to hit for any average in the major leagues. And you know, he made a substantial swing change, and it seems like he could hit for 250, 260, add in a little power, add in a ton of steals. And that's a great contributor that I think people are maybe pushing down a little bit because the projections are not, you know, adequately baking in the fact that he made a substantial change to his profile that you could jump on.
And I think, so if you look at the rolling charts on Jacob Marcy, I'm not going to tell you it's a great story. They're pretty much, they just move straight down. Basically, he came out swinging hot and then everything goes down. Except what you also have to realize is like he makes a ton of contact and he is fast. And my problem with Chandler Simpson is he'll hit like one home run a season, maybe. And there's an argument to be made that Chandler Simpson is not a big league hitter long term, right? Like he's a slap guy, and if he loses half a step, he's going to be out a lot. Whereas Jacob Marcy can hit, right? Look, again, I get it. He had a bad September last season, right? He hit like 230 in September. He certainly struggled there, but he didn't do anything that like really made me think like, oh, that it was all, you know, oh, now he's striking out a ton and everything's gone to heck. That's not what happened. He just had some bad batted ball luck. Right. It's not like he all of a sudden just started hitting everything into the ground. It's not as though he, you know, stopped pulling the ball at all. None of that stuff happened for Jacob Marcy. He kept hitting pretty well. And so, like, yeah, he had a good month and a bad month. But when you put it all through the wash, like, I think that's still the right move. It's still kind of, you can kind of meet in the middle, because it's not like, again, it'd be one thing if I said, oh yeah, and then in September he struck out a ton, or then in September his ground ball rate was 60% or something like that, right? Like he just couldn't handle major league pitching. That's not what happened. He could handle major league pitching. He just didn't get the results. I'm fine with that. That's an okay. If you're going to have a bad month, that's how I want you to have a bad month, right? Just some bad BABIP luck, right? Like the dude is fast. He shouldn't have as poor of a BABIP. I mean, he had he went from a 434 BABIP to a 284 BABIP month to month. He's probably in the middle of that somewhere with his speed, the way he puts the ball in play. It should be a little better. You know, it won't be 434. No one can carry that for a long time. It won't be 284. That's like a Kyle Schwarber BABIP, right? That's like all fly balls and crap. So it should land somewhere in the middle. And I think you're going to find a guy who has some power, has plenty of speed, and that's the guy, right? Like, it's him over Chandler Simpson by a fairly wide margin, which you see in the rankings, even though Chandler Simpson, I guess you could say like, well, who has 75 stolen base potential? I guess Chandler Simpson, if you thought he was going to stay in the lineup that long, right? If he was going to play enough. But Jacob Marcy is a legitimate everyday hitter and Chandler Simpson is not. And that's where the difference is.
And I think for the, you know, a slumping September is that he came out swinging out of his shoes. And I think a lot of major league pitchers who got scouting reports on him were like, whoa, this is not who I expected in Jacob Marcy. We're going to adjust and attack him differently. And for a guy that made a big swing change and is, you know, on this hot streak, it's how do you adjust? And I think obviously that still remains to be seen. And we'll see it once the 2026 season kicks off. But it seems like a guy under the hood looking at some of the process stuff, you know, the power is going to pop because he was hitting just unreasonably, uncharacteristically, you know, for power, but he made good decisions through and through the year, even in September. And as Scott said, a lot of it was the luck. But in terms of the contact ability, it really was like around league average and very much fluctuating around that, you know, average-ish line. And that's certainly a profile that plays. I'll take the odds of a guy that seems like a good hitter and provides that much upside stealing bases.
Perfect. Let's move on to tiers 9 through 11. And Nate, I don't mean to put you on the spot here, but this was kind of an interesting juxtaposition of these tiers, right? Where your notes after tier 9 talk about, you know, guys who have concerningly low floors, whereas your notes after tier 11 talk about, you know, it's a great spot to chase an infielder with upside. So you go from tier 9 where you're talking about guys with low floors to tier 11 where you're talking about guys with high upside. just trying to feel out where your line in the sand is, or if it's just kind of a position by position type thing, or if it's that place in the draft where you're like, I don't want to risk yet. Let's take lottery tickets later.
Yeah, I think I will kind of take the safer side of risk, if that makes sense, on when I want to call those shots when I'm filling out my hitter lineup. Because in tier nine, you're looking at guys who, for the most part, in most leagues are still in starting spots. You're expecting somewhat of starter production from, and you're not taking guys with kind of bigger questions on either playing time that I believe in or whatnot. I think like there's like an O'Neal Cruz who gets drafted pretty high, but he's in these rankings. And some of those shots, I just feel like the floor is so low that when you're losing a starter like that, you know, that's really scary. And then you have to make up ground, where I'd rather be in a place where I'm taking a more steady hitter in the sense that, you know, maybe they're only going to provide me 15-15 with an average, like nothing special, but then that gives me the flexibility to take maybe a higher risk, but you know, there's a bigger role question. I know I've been, you know, taking some safer second baseman so I can take shots on JJ Weatherholt later in drafts. Really setting it up that I want to find guys that, you know, if they're starting, it's great. I can kind of, you know, let it simmer early in the year. Whereas if I'm taking in, you know, in your tier 11, I know like Murakami and Torkelson are in this tier where, you know, we can find out, you know, in a week or two, is this a guy who is reasonably going to be on my roster for an entire season for the formidable future? And for guys, especially on the bench, I want to be making quick decisions. And I think just waiting a little bit on that risk allows you to do so, even if you're sacrificing just a little bit.
Yeah. It sounds like you're kind of, and I don't mean to steal Nick's glossary on this, but it sounds like you're kind of trying to find the thin line between hipsters and cherry bombs, right? The guys with the super high upside versus the guys who are going to be stuck in your lineup if they slump.
Exactly. And I play probably more roto leagues than I do head-to-head leagues, where I want to find a guy that if it's a riskier play, I have ways to go around it. Whereas it's not someone who has to be in my lineup all year, and I'm at the whims of, are they going to get hot enough times to make it worth it, or is it going to completely sink my year? Whereas like in some of my head-to-head leagues, or just kind of generally, you're allowed to take those shots because, you know, they'll win you a playoff week. And that's all that matters.
I think this is a really interesting spot in the rankings as well. Like the difference between tier 9 and tier 11, which doesn't sound like much. It ends up being about 30 rank spots or so. Maybe a little bit more if you go to the very top of tier 9 and the very back of tier 11. This is where the replacement level is in a 12-team league. This is where you find that. So when you talk about slightly above that line, you're talking about O'Neal Cruz, where, look, if you've got the right risk appetite in how you've drafted up till now, he can be a fun risk to take. Because when it comes to overall, like when it comes to physical skills, like there's hardly anyone in baseball who can hit it as hard as he can, who can run as fast as he can, who can do the things that he can do. But look at the other guys in tier 9, right? Bankable guys, right? Like Ian Happ, Stephen Kwan, Yandy Diaz, Brandon Lowe, Matt Chapman. That is bankable, right? Like, especially if you're, you know, if you're in a roto league, it is really hard to pass that bankable stuff to try to take O'Neal Cruz, which is not bankable unless you've got the right build up till then. Whereas when you look at tier 11, where Torkelson is, you're looking at guys who are, you know, you've got Murakami, Arias, Wilson, Tovar, Augustin Ramirez, Helio Ramos, Torkelson, Wilson Contreras, Jorge Polanco, Ozzy Albies. All those guys have floor problems, right? Be it injury or performance. So, like, you kind of don't care, right? You're like, yeah, well, they've all got floor problems. So let me at least take the guy who might hit 30 home runs in Spencer Torkelson. Or let me take Munetaka Murakami. I don't know if he can hit major league pitching long term, but if he can, he's going to hit 30 bombs, right? I'm willing to take that risk because all these guys have floor problems. Where again, when you look at tier 9, a lot of these guys don't. Ian Happ is one of the best floors you can get at this stage of the draft, right? Matt Chapman is an excellent floor. Like, he's the last good third, like he's the last bankable third baseman in the whole pool, right? There's a huge difference between these two tiers. Or like Stephen Kwan, like even if he doesn't steal quite as many bases as you want, you know what he is. You know he's got a plus plus hit tool. He's going to be a, you know, he's going to score runs. He's going to do things you need him to do. it's crazy how quickly you go from, oh, I don't know if I can take O'Neill Cruz with all these safe fours around to, oh yeah, I guess I'll take Torque. Oh, everyone's four sucks, right? Like it really changes fast around that time.
And one of the things, I think you made a really good point about the kind of positional floors, especially when you get to the end of that tier nine, there's a lot of, oh, this is kind of the last guy you want at a certain position. I mean, I think Matt Chapman's an excellent example at third base. And there's a lot of outfielders in that tier where it's like, this should be my outfield three in a three outfield league. Like these are the guys that I want. But then one of the things I'll really like to do if I'm grabbing a position that late, I'll like to immediately turn it around and take the high dart throw of saying, great, you know, I can throw this guy in a utility spot or not and see if he works out. Because if that dart hits, you know, all of a sudden I have immediate trade surplus to fill up a different need that I've identified on my team.
No, that's an excellent way to deal with that, right? Like I don't take Spencer Torkelson and then go take like another safe, you know, I don't take Spencer Torkelson and be like, yeah, and then I'll double dip with Wilson Contreras. Like, no, I'm not going to do that. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take a guy who is fairly bankable. And Torkelson's fairly bankable, right? The batting average might stink, but you know he's got a ton of power. He can do those things. And then you say, okay, now let me talk about Sal Stewart. Because if that doesn't play out, I've got a guy, right? I've got my guy. I've got my back end guy. And now I can take a dart throw to see if I can get something even better than that. And because I want to talk about Sal Stewart. But also, I think that like that's the kind of play you can make. You're like, all right, I'll take Wilson Contreras. And then I'm going to double dip on Sal Stewart, right? Or I'm going to take, you know, Matt Chapman, and then I'm going to come around and grab Sal Stewart because I'm like, now I might have two third basemen, right? Nobody else has got that. I might because Sal Stewart might play out.
That's a beautiful segue, Scott. Let's get into tier 12. Nate, one of your favorite players, I guess you said you had multiple shares of him earlier in the podcast. Sal Stewart is in this tier, and I know you're excited about him. Let's talk about Stewart, and then we'll move on to some other guys maybe in the later tiers that you're interested in taking shots on.
Yeah, so with Sal Stewart, the biggest thing that sold me on him in the offseason was a single chart from who else but Kyle Bland. He has this tool that is hitter skill similarities. So it takes all of these PLV-powered stats, so ranging from aggression to swing decisions, contact, power broken out into gap power and homer power. And Sal Stewart's biggest comp from 2025 was Aaron freaking Judge. Now, I'm not saying that he is Judgian. You know, I don't think that is a realistic outcome. But the thing that called out to me was that he showed that specifically in the gap power and homer power, no one, you know, rival Judge in terms of other player comps like Sal Stewart did. And you combine that with the fact that all of the prospect evaluators say that his hit tool is the best thing that he has to offer. So you're looking at a guy with a developing hit tool, you know, great under the hood power that should be developing, plays in Cincinnati, and it looks like things are carving out to be, you know, to give him a full-time role there. What's not to love? I think he really has a high chance of, you know, hitting 260, 270 with potentially 25, 30 home runs. And it seems with a guy whose hit tool is developing like that, I'm really intrigued to see, you know, what that looks like when it fully kind of comes to fruition, if he can really find his step with that in a full year this year.
One, the opportunity playing out for Sal Stewart's a big deal. So that was like early in the offseason. We're like, look, we don't know how, right? But if he can, it'd be great. And I'm all for unreasonable initial comps, right? Like Josh Sperry, if you're listening, I mean, he got me. I compared Josh Naylor to Bobby Witt. These are two very different looking men, right? But when it came to like what they can provide in terms of stats, it's kind of there, right? Like 20-something home run power, 30 stolen bases, a good average. Obviously, again, there's a gap in those rankings, like by 20 spots. There's a reason for that because Bobby Witt is better. But like, we're not saying Sal Stewart is Aaron Judge. We're saying like, there is a reasonable person can compare several of his skills to Aaron Judge's skills, right? That doesn't make you the same guy, but it makes you certainly very interesting. right? It certainly makes you someone that I'm like, if I'm going to take a late dart throw, why not the guy that I'm like, he sort of does this like Aaron Judge, right? Like that is what you do. Like, that's what a dart throw is. You're like, well, he's got this skill that very few people in the world have, right? And I don't mean this in a general, like, well, very few people are good enough to play Major League Baseball. Very few people are able to have a power metric that kind of looks like Aaron Judge's, right? Like the other dude that has, like the other dudes that have that are like Kyle Schwarber, Shohei Ohtani. Like those are the guys that you can kind of comp on power. And so to say like, well, look, Sal Stewart's not quite as strong, but there are similarities. It's like, okay, you bet for what ultimately equates to free in a 12 team league. Get out of here. Third base eligible? Come on. Like, what else do you want?
Exactly. And for clarity's sake here, some of the other names that he was comped to was 2021 Tyler O'Neill, which was his kind of breakout year where he hit .286 and 34 homers with the Cardinals. 2020 Marcelo Ozuna, which one of the shorter years, but that was his first year in Atlanta, 178 WRC plus, exceptional. There was also 2025 Buxton in there, and then a very weird one in 2021, Kyle Higashioka. And that's a good reminder that the similarity scores are, they're similarities. They're not, you know, they're not one for one. And there are things that, there are questions unanswered about Sal Stewart, and that's why he is going this late. But it's all to say that, you know, these are the risks that I want to take. And he just has such an exciting profile that I think is really going to pop. And Cincinnati, I think, is going to need him a lot this year.
Can you repeat what year that was for Higashioka?
I think 21.
I mean, yeah, he hit 10 home runs in 67 games, right? Like everything else sucked. But Higashioka actually has power, right? Like that's the one thing he's got. He doesn't have a whole lot else, but he does hit the ball. Like he can hit home runs. I shouldn't even say he hits the ball that hard. He kind of doesn't, but he's had 2021 Kyle Higashioka, who played for the Yankees at the time, had a 15.6% barrel rate that year. Right.
Yeah.
Like there was something there. Like it wasn't nothing, right? There's a reason, again, just because you can match these numbers, and it's a great point, Nate, that it doesn't mean like you are that guy. It just means that like his expected slugging that season was .519. Right. Because he hit the ball really well. And again, it doesn't mean you're going to be that guy. It just means like, if you're going to take a shot for free, like, yes, that's the kind of player to take a shot on, right? Like you don't take a shot on Gleyber Torres. You know what Gleyber Torres is, right? You take him because you forgot to draft a second baseman up till now. And he is a perfectly cromulent second baseman, right? You don't got to mention him now. You don't take a shot on Willy Castro. You know what Willy Castro is. He provides a very specific value in deep leagues by a guy who can play multiple positions. Fine. Right? Like that's what you get. That's not like, oh yeah, I took a shot. Maybe he's going to help me win my league. No, he's going to help you like tread water until something better happens. Sal Stewart is a guy who might actually change your fortunes, right? Willy Castro does not change your fortunes. He keeps you, he like raises your floor a little, but doesn't add to your ceiling. Sal Stewart doesn't really raise your floor, but he can absolutely add to your ceiling. That's exactly the kind of thing I think you need to do in 12 team leagues. And again, for almost no cost. And it's not as though you're trying to answer multiple questions. You're not trying to be like, well, if you know, how does he get the playing time to make an impact? And then if he gets the playing time, can he do something with it? It's like, well, he's got the playing time. He just needs to do something with it. That's key, right? We talk a lot about this podcast about, oh, I don't want to ask guys to do a bunch of things they've never done, right? I'm not asking him to, you know, I'm asking him to kind of be what he was in limited plate appearances last year, more, right? Just longer. That's fine, right? I'm not saying like, and also win a job and also learn a new position. You don't have to do any of that stuff, dude. Just kind of be what you were and do it more. And let's see what happens, right? It might be nothing, but you paid nothing. So it's okay if it's nothing, right? Because you already took your third baseman and now he's your second third baseman, right? It's the same thing. I'll say these two players don't really comp to each other, but it's the same reason you take Royce Lewis at this spot, right? You're like, ah, shoot, someone scooped me on Sal. I'll grab Royce Lewis because what if he is healthy? What if he is the Royce Lewis we saw for parts of a couple of seasons, right? It doesn't matter if he's not because I paid nothing. I'm not relying on him. It's the perfect time to throw a dart. And if you're going to throw a dart, throw one that, you know, I'm not going to overuse this metaphor, but like throw a dart towards the triple 20, right? Like, don't throw a dart at like, oh, double 10. Cool. No, throw a dart at the valuable spots. Throw a dart at something that could be something more than what you're paying, right? Don't throw a dart at a decent value. You don't throw a dart at Willie Castro. You throw a dart at Sal Stewart. You throw a dart at Royce Lewis. You throw a dart at Bryce Eldridge later, right? Like, those are darts to throw at the end of your draft.
And I think in regards to throwing darts, I think you can really get caught up in the what is market value that late. But when you get onto your utility bats, your bench bats and stuff like that, you know, these guys aren't going to be on your roster in 2 months. You're going to find the guys who work, and you can throw ADP out the door. You don't need to, you know, beat the market by two rounds in the 21st round or the 17th round for that matter. If you have a guy that you trust and you believe in, there's no reason you shouldn't be absolutely chasing that. The last thing I'll say on similarity scores, especially on the hitting side, is that, you know, there are only so many types of hitters, and it is really easy to, you know, believe that someone is, you know, unique in a way or does something that no one else does. And that does happen. You have, you know, outlier stats do and skills show up every now and then.
Luis Arraez, right? Luis Arraez is Luis Arraez, and other guys kind of are like him, sort of, but Luis Arraez is just Luis Arraez.
And the similarity scores are great in helping put players into archetypes. And they look at some of our PLV process plus powered numbers that are looking beyond the surface stats. And it's a great way to identify, oh, you know, Sal Stewart fits into this maybe strikeout or so with some power upside that you might not have seen before. And, oh, here are all these other names, player seasons of what guys did. You know, let me look into them. What did they do specifically? What are the ins and outs of that? And really, especially late when you have these guys with either unproven results or different holes in their skill set, it gives you a prime opportunity to look at what others are doing. And I will say that for Stewart, we average out the top 10 player comps into what their season looked like compared to Stewart. And Stewart at a 255 average. The top 10 comps, 280. Stewart's homers were pretty high, but I think that will, you know, it was 51 per 600 plate appearances, which probably isn't going to stick. But the top 10 player comps, 40. You know, that'll play. Regardless, it's really easy to kind of siphon a player off into one individual thing, but you do, especially on the hitting side, you kind of have to group them together and see how those skills have played out, you know, in real time.
Yeah, Sal Stewart's a great example of this hitter who has definitely plus power. Dude's power is plus whenever he's playing, right? Now, the decisions and contact have been inconsistent. At any given time, he's usually doing one of them okay, sometimes both, but usually one of them is, at least in terms of like his small play, you know, his small 215 pitches seen last year, one of those stats was usually above average at any given time between contact and decision making. And as we talked about early in the show, that's all that matters. If you can give me power plus one other thing at any given time, you've got a chance to be something, right? You can't just be power. But if you can give me contact or decision-making for any, you know, period of time, especially if it's a little bit of contact, because like, if you want to talk about a guy who's also sort of like this, you know, is Matt Wallner, who has plenty of decision-making and plenty of power and just absolutely no contact ability. So it doesn't really matter that much. Sal Stewart has shown that he can make some contact. Judge has contact problems, right? Aaron Judge has contact problems, but he makes up for it because he makes great decisions and he's got plus power, right? So he doesn't have to always make, you know, contact all the time, because when he finally does it, he's going to hit that ball super hard. Sal Stewart can do that too. That's the thing you're chasing. And again, it costs you nothing. In terms of like, you're not trying to figure out, ooh, well, I can't take a starting third baseman because I got to take Sal Stewart. And also, what I kind of like about that point is sort of thinking about the market. Who cares if you're one round early on him? Or a guy who I love being around early on is Kevin McGonigal. Yeah, his, you know, his price is shooting way up, but I don't care because I don't want to, like, it's not, I don't get extra points for getting a great value on McGonigal, right? I get extra points for having McGonigal on my team and him doing well. Not for like, oh, well, and I got him a round later than ADP. Who cares? At that point in the draft, don't worry about ADP anymore. Go get the guys who you think might make a difference.
That was an outstanding discussion on Sal Stewart. We spent about 15 minutes on him. And I loved it, but the U.S. just tied it in the bottom of the eighth. It's 2-2. Bryce Harper just hit a 2-run home run. So we really got to wrap this so we can watch the end of this game. Nate, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure. Tell the people where to find you and your work.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at underscore Nate Schwartz, where I'm tweeting, or N Schwartz. Oh my goodness. Baseball's consuming me. You can find me writing on the Pitcherless site. I'll be with Scott in the Reddit AMAs once the season kicks off. And then you can find me with Kyle Bland on the Approach Angle podcast. So going to be everywhere this year and excited for it to get going.
Scott, your turn. Tell us where we're to find you and your work.
Just the usual places, you know, got lists going on. The outfield rank should be coming out soon. I've been dragging my feet because it's a lot of guys to put in a list. It's 100 outfielders or so. But you can find me on Twitter at If The Chew Fits. Again, those Reddit AMAs will probably start up probably just before the season starts, whenever that Friday lines up. Nate, I'll let you know so that we can get that going. But it's always a great place to be. I think that's the one thing. I think if you're not sure what to do, the Reddit AMA is absolutely free, and you get a taste of what it's like to be in RPL Discords, and that we answer every question. There's nobody that asks a question that doesn't get an answer. And sometimes I get it. It's not till the next day or so because we miss you. But you're going to get an answer to your question. We're going to put it out there. We're going to give you as much info as we can. We rarely just say yes or no. We're usually giving reasons and analysis for each one. So I hope you check that out. It's absolutely free. I make nothing for doing it, except for, you know, the friends we make along the way. But those are important too. So please come and check that out.
Yeah, it's a great place to be. Scott and I, since really me joining last year, we went back and forth, and it's great to handle the questions together, to work, you know, we got to work on the hitter list a little bit together this year, which is great. And if you're in the PL Discord, you can bother us directly. It's a lot more easier way to reach us if you need, you know, quicker questions answered and stuff like that.
And please check out the Approach Angle podcast that Nate and Kyle are doing. Again, Nate, there's a reason that he helped me with the hitter list, right? He's coming off a research article of the year. There's great analysis there. And we try in this podcast to help you become a better fantasy player beyond just telling you players to pick, try to give you some insight on why we care about these players. And the Approach Angle podcast is just the next level of that. So I try to give you a little bit of a taste of what these stats are, but listening to those two is really going to help you understand what these stats are, what they mean, and how to use them, right? Like, just knowing a guy has a good WRC plus or good process plus is useless if you don't understand how to take that to another level and analyze it. And because everyone can look at a red Statcast page, how can you look at it differently that gives you an edge over everyone else that has a Google browser or, God forbid, AI? Which, please don't ask ChatGPT to do fantasy baseball stuff, not just because I want to keep my job, but because it's not very good at it.
Well, speaking of not very good at fantasy baseball, you can find me at Fade That Man on Twitter. you can find me in the Pitcherless Discord. Check me out on the QBless channels as well. I'm always chopping it up about fantasy football. I'm on not only Hacks and Jacks, but also the QBless podcast network with Dave Felicio on a weekly basis. So appreciate you guys checking those out. QBless, the sister site of Pitcherless for fantasy football. On behalf of Nate, on behalf of Scott, I'm Brett. Thanks for joining Hacks and Jacks. We'll see you later.